In my previous talk, I was exploring what kind of seeing can free us, and what kind of seeing that we're using here in the retreat, which is different from the regular daily life, minimal kind of awareness that we need in order to cope with life and function. And here we're doing something deeper and a bit different. And I mentioned it's like the iceberg, the Tishima who's under the water is important for us here. In daily life, we often feel the only place we know is the 10% above the water. So today I want to actually explore, so how does it work? How does this seeing free us? And it's quite sometimes subtle. For example, someone that is easily angry and upset can say, well, okay, I know I'm angry. I'm completely aware that this anger is rising up in me every time my partner tells me I'm an idiot. And I know it, and it's still there. So seeing didn't free the anger. And maybe you need something else. Seeing may not be enough. So one answer to that is actually it's true that in our daily life and also in the Dharma, in the spiritual journey of Buddhist teaching, actually seeing needs to be part of a way of life, which is called kusala, meaning healthy harmony, a sense of rightness, a sense of ethics, a sense of relationship with things, a beneficial relationship with things, a way we live with dana or generosity and a big heart. And so, indeed, seeing is not the only thing that we need in order to be free. It actually needs to be embedded in a beneficial, healthy, and a spiritual way of life. It's not just a technique or a way of using the mind. But the seeing can do more or less also, more or less everything. And the only thing that that the problem is when people don't notice, if you ask the same person, so you've been on retreats, yes, you've been practicing for a while and aware, more aware, more mindful, yes. Is your anger the same extent and the same power as it was before the retreats? Oh no, it's much less. So in other words, there's a story here about the power of something like anger, which is so biological and so powerful, and the power of mindfulness to hold it. So there is a balance here, and therefore we need to be wise. But we can't expect seeing anger, namely seeing the way it arises in us, the buttons are pressed by our partner saying this, and boom, explosion of anger. We can't expect that the seeing will hold such a powerful emotional, biological response as anger and make it disappear in 5 minutes. But we just need to be a bit aware of that, or modest. But fundamentally, seeing frees because there is something in the seeing itself that is free. And a small image of that, it comes from the Tibetan Mahayana tradition, which says that Sitting in the ear is a little Buddha. Sitting in the eyes is a little Buddha. Sitting in the touch is a little Buddha. Sitting in the taste is a little Buddha. Sitting in the mind is a little Buddha. So omer that the senses are actually quite clean. There is something pure in our connection with the world called the way we know the world that happens in the present moment. So I said that in the Buddhist world, freedom, liberation, and also a sense of the divine, a sense of the sacred, a sense of limitless, is inside experience and not something that we look for somewhere else. So let me first of all ask, what is an experience? What is an experience? So in Buddhist psychology, an experience happens because we have a body. The body-mind exists. We're born into a body called nama-rupa. Nama-rupa means is like mind-body, or nama is like name and rupa is form. So it can be translated as the physical and mental, or self and the world, because rupa is also the elements, earth, air, fire, water. So it's us and the world, us in the world, and the body being the entity which has mind and body together and world. So experiences come because we belong to the world. Nama rupa means we're in the world. Because we're in the world, we experience the world. And what we experience, and if we don't experience this, we can't live. We will not exist. We experience a constant stream of contact between us and the world from the moment we are born, probably before. There's a constant stream of contact that is constantly arriving through the senses and the mind. In the Buddhist world, the mind is a sense, like the ears or the eyes, because it simply provides information, memory, for example. So the mind is another sense, like touch. So nama rupa, the body, is receiving constant impressions, senses, basic information about the world through the body, through the senses. The world and the body are in connection all the time. But from that place of connection and contact, we build perception, tvisot. We build an understanding of the world. This is the process of building. We build something. We don't just receive the senses, we make them into something. We learn about the world. We know what is a tree. We know who we are. We know how to cross the road. We know how to do well in school. There's a perception going on that builds networks in the mind, in the brain, called knowing the world, and supports these networks. So these are descriptions of the world that we live with. The descriptions need memory, so we have memory. Without memory, Alzheimer also can't really exist. So memory is needed. Structure, a sense of mental structures, allow us to be a person, allow us to know the world, allow us to, as I say, cross the road without getting killed by a car. Sometimes we get killed by a car anyway. But do our best to survive in the world. And part of that is directed by our interests. And this is an important thing. Vedana, we talked about earlier in the instructions, is the liking, not liking. Our interests drive the way we build the world. So part of all of that is our interest, what we like, what we don't like, what we choose, what's good for us, what we pay attention to. What we pay attention to builds our consciousness, builds our structures. If I mean, the first ships from the Western countries, when they came to Polynesia and the Pacific, the islanders there didn't see them as ships. They didn't know what they were. They didn't see them as being something. And we ourselves, if we see something weird, we don't know what it is. We shut it out. We pay attention to what's important for us. I was talking about it before in the group, that a thief will only see pockets. Ganav rak roye kisim. Because he's interested in pockets, not in the sky and the birds. So what we're interested in, that's the way we build our world. That's why it's so important, Vedana, liking, not liking. Because this place is the way we build our life. And consciousness is operating all the time behind the scene in the subject-object duality. So we know an object, there is a knowing, there is us, and there is an object. All of this is Buddhist psychology, and I think to a large extent Western psychology also. It's not so different. It's called the aggregates in the Buddhist language, the khandhas. And it's about the fact that an experience is made of elements and components and pieces. And we have to have all of these pieces that put together an experience. So what happens is all of these pieces we put together to make an experience. An experience can be a breath, listening to a bird, can be a view that we have about ourselves, can be an understanding, it can be built into feeling, emotion. And what actually happens all the time is that we build stories, we build a movie of our life, we build explanations, we add knowledge, we keep adding and adding and accumulating more and more of the stories, like the movies are endless. And they're assumed to be real. We assume that our life is real and what we see is real. I remember one of the very shocking experiences I had in my life was in California, in the 60s, under LSD. And at that time, LSD was legal. It wasn't illegal. It was absolutely fine. You just could get it. And there was no problem with it. And it was sacred. It was like going on a deep Vipassana retreat. It was absolutely fine and very blessed and very... and kadosh, and holy, but very strong, like powerful, and I think the quality of it was good or something. I don't know, but it was very, very strong, at least for me. But what was strong was the understanding that when I saw a tree, It was no longer a tree, but a mass of colors and shapes like a kaleidoscope that was constantly moving and changing, and there was no tree there. And so it left me with this understanding that there is no tree there. It's me that made the tree. And I take a few micrograms of something and the tree disappears. Just because of some microgram of some stuff. It shows me there was no tree. It's just the assumption of tree, the habit of tree, the networks in the brain called tree. The reshatot b'moach, ta'ei moach. So all the time we are confirming reality and proving to ourselves reality. And this gets very painful if we have a reality like tavnit or psychological pattern. I'm no good. I'm useless. Everything will confirm it in life. We'll go out in the street and we'll say, this boy in the meeting in the street, this dog passing by, look what the way he's looking at me, he also thinks I'm no good. We will constantly confirm our patterns, forgetting that they're not real. They're constructions that we made out of conditions, out of learning, out of experiences. It's tragic when it comes to conflict. We know there is an enemy. Everyone believes it. The whole society goes in that direction, and it's absolutely seen to be true. No one's standing up there like the boy with the emperor's new clothes, you know, who says, but the emperor's naked. And then it leads to war, because everybody's convinced. Nobody's looking at the truth of it. So the seeing that we're doing here is unpacking, is deconstructing. Because the only thing that is constructing a known and fixed world, including these painful patterns of thinking and mental constructions, which we say, okay, it's all right to have a mental construction that a tree is a tree, but what about a mental construction that every Palestinian is an enemy? Or a mental construction that says, I'm useless? Or a mental construction that says, I hate my friends, my children, my partner, all the painful things in the world, which we believe. They're based on attachment, which we believe to be true. And these are based on the experiences I talked about, the constructions that we build. So seeing is fundamentally deconstructing. It's opening the eyes. And two small images that I'll bring from the tradition, one is from the tradition and one is from today. The magician, a kosem. Everyone's sitting around watching the magician. He's doing tricks, and everyone goes, "Oh, wow! Look what he's doing! Look, he's making a rabbit appear from nothing. Wow, that's amazing!" And everyone is convinced. But somebody goes behind the stage and watches what goes on and realizes that it's all based on tricks. That the magician just made lots of tricks and everyone believes what they see. So the seeing that we do is going behind the stage and seeing the way we built these things that we believe to be true. These attachments we have, these constructions. So there's hitpakhut in Hebrew. I think I mentioned the word before. I like the word. it is that sense of being able to see fresh the way we built our world and the way it imprisons us and the attachments, the heyakzuyot, that we're living inside those attachments. The automat, the automatic pilot, because we're inside attachment to the way the world, we think the world is, and we believe it. Another image, a very simple one that I appreciate my daughter Tamarin, because she's an artist, and sometimes, you know, I can watch a film, and I'm a bit like a child, and I watch the film, and I really enjoy the drama and the story, and she comes along and says, "You see that shot? The director, actually, his camera angle is like this. And actually, he's a great director because he's showing you this. And you look at behind what's going on, and you see, and all of a sudden, I lost the story." But there's a certain wisdom in that. I'm very appreciative. Well, great. You know, thank you for that fresh eye. I was lost in the story. I enjoy being lost in the story sometimes. And we need this seeing, hitpakhut, does need us to be more deep in the way we look at things. It needs us, and a lot of what we're doing here, and I'm sorry because you've had so much instructions over this last few, and we keep giving so many instructions day by day, and talks, instructions, and every retreat is like that. It doesn't matter whether you do a retreat in America or it'll be lots of, and it sometimes feels a bit much, but it's because the seeing isn't easy. We're trying in 1 week to kind of undo, deconstruct a little bit habits of lifetime. And this needs subtlety. For example, it needs to understand how to see without too much struggle, not to fight ourselves, to be a bit kind to ourselves, to allow things to be what they are, not to fight ourselves, which is more of the same stuff, not to try and push ourselves and to be better, to fix ourselves. Then we're back in the same narrative as before. We're trying to see, hitpakhut, to open the eyes and see that what the constructions we make are themselves not the reality. They are construction that we built around perception and memory and belief. So we begin to see that a story is just a story, not the truth. We begin to understand we don't need to react on automatic pilot. We don't need to be reactive to everything that arises, to be able to watch things as they come and as they go, without reacting, without getting, I want more of this, and I want less of this, and I need this, and I don't need that. The same stuff that makes us construct a rather frozen imprisonment in kind of an automatic life of coping. It's modern diyot. So we don't need to buy into it, to give importance anymore to the usual habits of, I want it to be like that, and I know that that's the truth, and a fact. And I do like the Byron Katie question, which is, I think, helps. Byron Katie, spiritual teacher, you may know about her, but she just basically has two questions, which are so good, and that we really need to ask these questions. And we're doing it here, actually. Only maybe we're not asking it in this right way. But everything that arises, we can ask, Is it true? And is it helpful? That kind of question, the whole construction can collapse. What we believe to be true, what we think, assume to be true, what we, the way we live our life according to these constructions, suddenly, wait a minute. Is it really true? Am I really like this? This message I'm giving 24 hours to myself of judgment, shiputiyut, against myself, is it really true? Or is it just a habit of mine that I believe, that I'm no good? There was a very funny story that some of you may have heard, but I have to repeat it. It's apparently a true story, and there was a meeting of Tibetan, Zen, and Theravada teachers at Harvard University. And in the course of the meeting, the Zen master produced an orange and brought it out and said, "What is this?" Zen masters are very fierce, right? They're not like Vipassana teachers at all. "What is this?" There was silence. "What is this?" He held it orange. "What is this?" The Tibetan teacher turned to his translator and said something in Tibetan, and the translator said to the Zen master, "My Tibetan master asks, have you never seen an orange before?" The understanding that we gradually, the seeing that frees us is a gradual understanding that everything is related to context, to conditions. Because of certain conditions, we see things in a certain way. And then we forgot. And I walk with my dog in Clil, and I see a pile of dog khaki in the road. I say, not interesting to me, but my dog, I think, loves it. And it must be to my dog like the best uga. Different points of view on the same pile of khaki. And no one's right, no one's wrong. It's just different points of view based on context. Dogs do this and humans do that because of conditions. There's a classic image of this, that of the rope and the snake, very classic Eastern tradition, yogic tradition, Buddhist tradition, that you go into a dark room and you see something coiled in the corner, and your immediate reaction is, "It's a snake." And then you turn on the light and you see it's just a coil of rope. So you've imposed your conditioning on the senses. The conditioning is stronger than the senses. The senses tell you it's a rope. But your conditioning is stronger, based on fear. Our conditioning will pay attention to the meal that we have had for lunch and be interested in the rice, in whether the cooks, our angels in the kitchen, produced magic today or not, whether it's tasty, how I want it, and how I like it, and how I enjoy it, and I taste it. We forget that this meal comes from the universe This rice is grown in California or in Burma or somewhere, and the Selek is coming from the Galil, and this is, and someone's grown it, and someone's sown it, and the sun has produced it, and someone's cooked it, and then it goes into our body, and then it goes out into the toilet, and we forgot the whole thing. The only thing we're interested in is, does it taste nice? And as soon as we finished eating, it's gone from our consciousness altogether. But this plate of food is a huge story with a history in, like, the planet itself. Like the cosmos is in this plate of food, because it's endless. It needs the air, it needs the sun, it needs the water, it needs people, it needs cooking, it needs fire, it needs thought, it needs sefer bishul of tovana. It needs so much, and it carries on after you've eaten it. It goes back into the sea, into the water, into the biuv. It goes on, and it makes more in the end, and it goes round, and there's no end to this meal. If we really look, it's infinite. But we don't look. All we see is a small slice, because they're prusaktana. This food, is it tasty or not? I'm hungry. That's a really, really small slice. So we really need a bigger looking. A looking underneath, a looking behind the what appears to be. A looking that penetrates. A looking that breaks up the constructions. Also a story that for my life that I've told before, so you know, those old people who have been with me on retreats probably have heard this before, but I still have to say it. I think the most, in my whole life, the most powerful Dharma lesson was when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I began to read the Jungle Book of Mowgli, of Kipling, which I had in a very old edition, like one of the old-time editions of 100 years ago, someone gave me. So I loved the smell of the book. It was like leather book. And I read it again and again and again. And what was fascinating for me, and really I think set me off on this journey, was I realized that Mowgli thought he was a wolf because his parents were wolves and told him he was a wolf. Zev. Therefore, Stephen thinks he's Stephen simply because his parents tell him he's Stephen. So he doesn't exist in any way other than mikre. It's an accident. It's not real. This Stephen is just thinks he's something because he happened to be born from parents that told him he's like that, or that in London and North London and went to school like this and went to these conditions. Because of these conditions, I exist. With other conditions, it will be different. So there's nothing there except conditions. That came to me when I was 5 or 6 years old. It was like mind-blowing. Nothing exists. It's all conditions. Conditions make Mowgli a wolf. Conditions make Stephen this. Conditions make all of you as you are, but you don't exist in any other way than conditions. Conditions are operating to make you think you're something. But you're just a bunch of conditions, each one of us. You're not more than that. There's a beautiful Pali phrase, whatever we think that something is, it is other than that. So, I want to explore a little bit what kind of understanding comes to us about an experience that gives us, that frees us from these constructions that we believe in. And the first, and this is called the teaching of the three characteristics, or in the Tibetan tradition, the three seals, Khotmim, seals?
Kalpeya.
Huh? Chotamot. The first is I want to mention is anicca, meaning everything passes by. So things can't be solid because we can't hold on to them even if we try. Actually, anger is for us a big problem, but try and be angry right now. I invite you right now to be angry. Nu? Yalla. Even if you want to be angry, you can't. We can't hold on to anger. It comes and it goes because of the universe, not because we can design anger. The tachnen. It comes and it goes with conditions. We get a button pressed, we're angry. The button is not pressed, we're not angry. We can't hold on to things even if we try. They may seem like they're stuck, but actually, if we look, we can't hold on to them because they keep flowing by. One of the most sort of fundamental statements of anicca in Buddhist philosophy is all compounded things are impermanent. Compounded things is really everything. Everything is put together by, like the meal, is put together by the sun and the moon and the water and the earth and the, so the meal isn't actually a thing. It's put together by many, many other things, and so are we. So all compounded things. How do you say in Hebrew compounded things? Okay.
Fabrikim.
Fabricated thing. Okay. Anyway, everything that exists is made up of many things, and it's impermanent because the many things that make up are all changing, are all moving. We don't like it when it's our body. Our body's made up of many things, millions of biochemical processes going on all the time, millions of cells that are living and dying. Our body is totally dynamic, and we just look at our body for any one bit of our body, it's nothing but change. But we hate to feel our body is getting old and getting sick and not being and changing, and we want it to be bright and fit and well and constant and not changing, and then it changes. So conditions change, things may appear to be solid and permanent, but they are never. The point of view is changing constantly. We may have the most problematic mind stuck in some real loop in the mind here, sitting here, chofrim, you know, digging into some psychological issue that we have, and then all of a sudden the bell rings and it's gone. Where went that heavy psychological that I need years? I've been to a psychologist to try and deal with this, and the bell rang and it's gone. A thought has an end. A feeling has an end. A body has an end. If we really understand that and really see it, thoughts liberate themselves. We will see liberation happening in the nature of things. We will not have to hunt for freedom. We will experience freedom in the moment. In the experience itself, is freedom. A thought liberates itself and liberates us if we see that it has just a beginning and an end. And when it's gone, it's gone. Something else may come, or we can feel some space in us, some freedom. And it applies to everything. I quoted just now in the group William Blake, who said, "Kiss the joy as it flies, and we will live in eternity's sunrise." It brings us to something nitzchi. If we can also joy, that we all want joy, but also joy is based on conditions, and also joy flies. And we welcome it, we're happy with it, we kiss it as it flies. But we let it fly. And we live. So one of the places that we really can free us is this place where we feel in the present moment that all experience is coming and going and is fundamentally free. And that our habit of making things permanent, kiba'on, is the problem. But if we actually experience a nature again and again and again and again, the beginning and the ending of everything, that is at the heart of experience, one of the three characteristics that helps us to be free. A second of the three characteristics is dukkha, is painfulness or unsatisfactoriness. And we just have to relate to that. We really can't avoid it. We sit here 40 minutes minding our own business, completely kind of, sitting in our place, and our body goes crazy, our body hurts, pain arises, and we can be a ballet dancer, we can be a great yogi with an amazing body. Makes no difference. The body hurts. And dukkha arises because we are holding on to things, because written into the body-mind is all the attachments, heachzuyot, all the contractions, all the lessons, all the pains, all the conditioning that we've received in our life. It's written into the system. It's going to be there because we've been shaped by life. And this isn't a joke, and not conditioning is not easy. So we arrive in this moment with a shape, with a past, with like I said, structures, with conditioning, with a set of fixed knowledge and views and thoughts and impressions and patterns and psychological issues and so on. And it's somehow got to be dealt with, it's got to be seen, not avoided, but seen and known and let go of. In the tradition there's three kinds of dukkha. There's dukkha, which is a very obvious pain, like disease, injury, loss of someone close to us, someone we were having a great relationship and then we got thrown out by our partner, dukkha. Then there's a dukkha of change, which is exactly connecting to what I said before about change. That means the changeability of things causes us suffering. We want to stay a entity. We want to survive. The self is busy being somebody. The self is busy trying to resist change. I'm trying to kind of, I want a really comfortable house where everything is going to work fine and nothing, the car won't break down and my family will be fine and I will not lose things and I will not be sick and I will be successful and I will have money in the bank. And so we don't like change. We don't like to feel the lo yadua or iyadia, the non-knowing. We like to know what's going on. We like, all of this is telling us a certain kind of pain of change. And the third kind of dukkha is dukkha of more subtle, of conditionality. The fact that we are shaped by life, by conditions, or hatnaya, conditioning, is painful. And there is the story that I like about a guy that goes into a tailor to ask him to make a suit, a khalifa. And the tailor said, sure, I'll make you a suit. Come back in a couple of weeks. Be ready. He said, you don't want a fitting before? No, don't worry. It'll be fine. He came in, tried on the jacket, one sleeve longer than the other. And the tailor said, look, the sleeve is longer than the other. And the tailor said, don't worry, if you walk like this, then it'll be fine. And the buttons are not lined up. Don't worry, you button it like that, and then just walk like that, and the jacket will be fine. And the trousers are tight here. Don't worry, if you just put out your tummy like this, or put in your tummy like that, you'll be fine. And the legs, they're not the same length. Don't worry, if you walk like that, then it'll be fine. So this guy put on the suit and sort of walked into the park, and there was two people sitting on a bench. And one said to the other, oh, look at this poor cripple. And the other one said, yes, he's a poor cripple, but he's got a wonderful suit. And I think that, you know, we are, that's us actually. Dukkha of conditioning. We are forced to wear a suit that doesn't necessarily fit us, and we fit ourselves into the suit, which is conditioning. And once we know that, once it's clear to us, we can take off the suit. We have to see that it's painful. And it's useful, we talked about this before, the hindrances are the way we do it inside the retreat. We know what's coming up is Isheke, that's fine. That's telling us, that's our teacher right now. It's telling us about pain. It's telling us a discomfort. It's telling us about conditioning. And all we need to do is acknowledge it. Okay, yes, I see you. You're an unpleasant visitor, but you also come and go, and I'm not controlled by you. And slowly, slowly, that way we take off the suit. And the suit, by the way, is like everything. It's our tafkidim in life. It's our labels that we put on things, on ourselves or on others. It's the images we have of ourselves, of how we feel about ourselves. It's life that we can't control. It's the nisibot that are controlling us. And so that brings us dukkha. And the third of the characteristics is anatta. And anatta is the absence of a solid, recognizable, solid existing self. It's that when we try and look and see what is running this show, we can't find it. This apparent subject here, the boss running the show, we can't really find it. Anatta is the selflessness of things. Actually, it's just a sense that we can get slowly, slowly, through experience, the experience is quite impersonal. When the life flows, when we experience life of trushot, of sensations in the hands or the feet, actually they don't have a label saying, they belong to you. They don't. They're just life passing through. They don't have a message, they belong to you, I belong to you. We have an illusion that things belong to us, but if we look carefully, things don't necessarily belong to us. And this is an important insight, a very fundamental insight. And it applies to everything, actually, not only us, but any object. And just like I said about the meal, the restricted view of the meal of lunch is a limited view of the meal as a thing. But if we look at it more carefully, we see it's not a thing. This meal is a process that involves the whole universe, and so are we, a process that involves the whole universe, and so is this object, and so is every object. And so it's important, we're talking about what the Tibetans would call emptiness, but I think this is not a helpful word, because it's actually more fullness than emptiness. It's the fact that everything is connected, and everything is passing through, and everything is conditions that make us, and relationship. And so it's actually fullness, not emptiness. But it is the fact that things are not fixed selves that are permanent, and I even identify them and say, this is me, a fixed entity. We have the tendency to think that. And actually, in some way or other, all life has it. And there's a Pali word, ahamkara, which means the I-making tendency of life. Life tends to make I, make a me. An ant does it in its way, and a dog does it in its way, animals will do it in their way, humans will do it in their way. A sense of I, some basic sense of I. It's a sense, or it's a experience, but it's not ultimately true. Ownership, ba'alut, is another of these ways of thinking. And it's not true. What do we own? Do we own our body? Really? Is it mine, my body? You know, it's fine. We feel good, but when we have a virus like the one I have right now, can I tell my body? What can I say to my body? It's not mine. The virus is doing its thing. Is it my thought, really? Does it belong to me? Does it have a label? Well, you could say, yes, it feels like my thought, but actually look at it more carefully. It's just a thought. We can't even control it and say, no, I don't want you, I want another one. So even thoughts that seem so close to us, if we look carefully, they're actually not, we don't have ownership of the thought. They are a stream that comes from the world, from the past, from all the voices that we've heard of other people. We have our parents in our head going, blah, 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 you should be like this, you should be like that. You know, that's voices, they're not ours. So there's less. It's freeing us to, especially our patterns, our tavniyot and tendencies, to be less personal and seeing that in experience. The experience is just experience, it doesn't really belong to us. And that frees us. So all these three characteristics, anicca, dukkha and anatta, are what we discover inside experience, that we discover it again and again and again. We just get close to the nature of experience, and we find there that experience is much freer than we thought. And slowly, 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 by again and again understanding this and knowing this deeply, something opens in us. So these three characteristics are not themselves nibbana or awakening, but they are the ground of awakening. They invite awakening. They prepare us for awakening because they are undoing the attachments, the heyakzuyot. And there's one thing that all Buddhists will agree, the big problem, and you probably heard it from Simi yesterday, the one big problem we have is the second noble truth, attachment. And I think I want to finish with a quote. Actually, I wrote it in it's in my book, but as this talk is in Hebrew, but it's in one of the articles here in my book, which is in Hebrew, but I'll read it in English because this is an English talk. And just as a sort of a small personal story of a moment where the clarity or the awakening arises. And it just gives you a sense of what this is about. I had just been digging in the vegetable garden. So I grow my vegetables in Clil, so I'm there a lot. I had just been digging in the vegetable garden, preparing another bed for the summer vegetables. I stood in the middle of the garden and relaxed. I took in the whole picture and it suddenly felt overwhelming. The garden exploded with richness. The multiple varieties of green, the red roses, the healing and sacred orange calendula, the herbs, the tastes and the aromas, the intoxicating smell of deep wet earth. It was the result of the work of my hands, but at the same time of everything else in the world. This joyful cycle had no purpose, no end. It was just the beauty of engagement with life. What is the awakening? It's the participation. It's melting into the moment. The garden needed me to know it so we could exist together. As the knower of the garden, I was just one more part of the picture along with each radish.